In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
It used to be that Democrats and Republicans got along because they both had the same goal, make America great. They just had different paths toward that end, but they were both heading in the same direction on parallel paths, make America better. But that's not the case anymore, not with today's elected Democrats. Today's Democrats no longer want to make America great. They want to do away with America altogether. They want to see it destroyed, to have their version of utopia rise from the ashes. We see a lot of ashes in Oregon right now. Over 1 million acres have been burned. At last count, 2,357 homes in southern Oregon alone have been lost. But it's not just the forests. Look at what's happening in our cities. Portland, over 100 days of violent riots, businesses shuttered or burned, Antifa and Black Lives Matter on the streets threatening people with violence and fire, and they shouted, "They will burn it all down," and they meant it, the system and the city. Left-wing Democrat policies have failed. Left-wing environmentalist policies have failed. As we said last week, letting it burn is not a valid environmentalist policy if, at the same time, you claim global warming is making the earth drier and hotter. Global warming should have meant that you took even more actions to protect the forests, not what they did, which is nothing. Instead of thinning the forests, building fire breaks, and logging responsibly, they let the fuel build up like a carpet of matchsticks in the forest, and then pretend to be shocked that it all went up in flames. If you know there's a problem and you do nothing about it, you should be out of politics. We have spent literally hundreds of billions of dollars on climate change. Where did it all go? Windmills, solar panels, research, studies on forest management? Why is it so much of left-wing spending goes to theory rather than boots-on-the-ground reality? When it comes to Democrat politicians, you have seen the destruction they have caused in our streets, in our homes, if you're still lucky to have one standing, in our businesses, in our forests, and on our farms and everywhere else. It's time to do some clear-cutting of elected Democrats. Now, what if you live in an area where you can't elect Republicans because it's an overwhelming Democrat district, like Portland? Or maybe you live in a safe district for Republicans. Well, either way, you can still help do some Democrat clear-cutting by helping a Republican get elected in a close district. Flip that from a Democrat to a Republican. You can donate, which always helps. You don't have to be in their district to donate to them. That helps them by advertising to get their word out, which is expensive. But they can also hire more staff, do more outreach, be able to work with more volunteers, all sorts of things. Today, we'll be talking with Alex Garlados, a candidate for Oregon's 4th Congressional District, that's in Southwest Oregon, and you can help get him across the finish line, replacing a longtime do-nothing Peter DeFazio. We'll also be talking about that Democrat destruction with former attorney and best-selling author Scott McEwen, about holding politicians and their violent Antifa and Black Lives Matter henchmen accountable. Why is it that the FBI is so sure it's not Antifa that's been out there starting fires? And is it time to start charging all of these people with sedition? But first up, I'd like to welcome now Alex Garlados back to the show. He is the former Army National Guardsman who helped stop an armed terrorist on a Paris-bound train back in 2015. He has now won his party's primary for the 4th Congressional District. He is now, running now against Peter DeFazio, who has been there pretty much since forever. Alex, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Peter DeFazio has been in office longer than I've been alive.
I know, it's astonishing. I'd like to talk to you really about the fires here in Oregon. This is obviously the biggest topic right now in Oregon. We've had some massive wildfires, more than a million acres burned, about a dozen lives lost, hundreds and hundreds of homes and businesses burned in Lane County, which takes in CD4. A couple of communities were complete losses, both Vida and Blue River. Talk to us a little bit about what you've seen as you've gone around CD4.
Well, I mean, this is a problem that's been going on for a long, long time. Just the mismanagement of our forests has really kind of come to a head. And Now we have the worst fire season we've had in probably over 100 years. And as I go across the district, I mean, I think people, for the most part, are upset. I mean, I've talked to evacuees and people like that, and they just, I mean, we've been talking about this problem for years, and no one has done anything about it, and I don't think they will do anything about it. I mean, Peter DeFazio just voted against salvage logging a few weeks ago, and wow. That's one of the most common sense compromises when it comes to managing our forests better, and he can't even compromise on that. So, I mean, I really think it's time for a leadership change. We've let really Democrats and the federal government run our forest policy for about 30 years now, and we're significantly worse off because of it. And we really need to start changing how we manage our forests, or it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
Well, see, that's the thing, though. Democrats used to be for loggers. They used to be the blue-collar guys. Now they seem to be completely opposed to it.
Well, absolutely. And even Peter DeFazio used to be considered kind of a moderate Democrat. But, I mean, really starting in the late 80s and early 90s, they really shut down logging in Western Oregon. And, I mean, we're now seeing the results.
Yeah, absolutely. In business school, which is my background, one of the things they consistently teach managers is that when there's a problem, you go to talk to the people closest to that problem to both understand the problem and listen to them on how to fix it. So these forest fires, what are people in timber and forest management saying about how to fix the problem and how forests should be managed?
Well, obviously more local control would be ideal, but unfortunately we've kind of given that up to the federal government, and that's how the law's written. But even then, the federal government in D.C. should be listening to the people in Oregon and the people that actually have to live with the policies they make. And that's really the root of the problem, is there's no motivation for politicians in D.C. to solve this problem because they don't have to live with it, really.
Well, you mentioned that DeFazio voted against salvage logging, which is just boggles the mind, especially at a time like this. What was his reasons for that?
I wish I knew. That'd be a question for him. But I mean, salvage logging to me is the most common sense compromise, because these trees are burned anyway. They're just going to rot if you don't salvage them and bring in money to the economy and county governments. And not to mention, of course, it helps sequester carbon and, of course, prevents forest fires from happening in the future. And that's why our forest fires are getting larger and larger and burning hotter, is because we leave all this dead timber and overgrowth in the forest. And it just compounds the problem year after year after year.
Yep, absolutely. All right, let's go and take a break there. Come back, we'll have more with Alex Garlatos. He's running for Congress in CD4, which is in Southwest Oregon. Coming up, we'll be talking some more about supporting Oregonians and some, well, disturbing things that have been happening. And welcome back. We're talking today to Alex Garlatos. He's a former Oregon National Guardsman and candidate for U.S. Congress in Oregon's 4th Congressional District. CD4 takes in Southwest Oregon. That's from the California border up to the outskirts of Albany here in the valley. It also includes Coos, Curry, Douglas, Lane, and Benton counties, and most of Lynn and Josephine counties. You might know Alex Garlatos as the guy who helped stop a terrorist on a train bound for Paris, which was made into a major film directed by Clint Eastwood. And Alec, you know, as I'm sure you know, groups like Timber Unity, their response has been absolutely incredible during this forest fire situation here, helping move people and livestock out of harm's way, getting hay from Klamath Falls up into the valley to feed the animals that have been displaced. Do you have anything to say about Timber Unity? I mean, I just can't say enough about them.
Oh, well, it's an amazing grassroots organization, and I think it's, of course, born out of the mismanagement, not just of the forest, but of course of the whole cap and trade movement, and really kind of an anti-Kate Brown movement. And I really hope that all the members of Timber Unity actually show up and vote and get active in politics so that we can actually turn the state around long term.
Yeah, absolutely. I would certainly like to see that. CD4, I just can't figure out why they keep voting for DeFazio. You mentioned cap and trade. It's odd enough, from a 2010 the questionnaire, he was actually against cap and trade back then. Now all of a sudden he's for it.
He used to have a B rating from the NRA as well, and now he has a D minus.
Yeah,
so he's just gotten very extreme overall in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Absolutely. And according to an OPB article, DeFazio not only supports the new Green Deal, he also co-sponsored it. I wonder how many of people in CD4 know that he was a co-sponsor of the new Green Deal. He says that he did so because, quote, the world faces catastrophic droughts, extreme weather, and other huge problems if it fails to take big actions. So the forest burned because the environmental left took no action. If you believe in global warming, then shouldn't you have done more to protect and manage our forests, not what the left does, which is nothing, except create a massive pile of matchsticks? I mean, if you believe climate change, shouldn't you be taking better care of our forests?
Well, I mean, especially when it comes to, again, the amount of carbon that's dumped into the atmosphere from a forest fire and the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere from that same forest rotting after it's burned when it's not salvage logged. Not to mention, if you're really that concerned about it, you should be more worried about forest fires and stopping them and managing the forest properly instead of sponsoring a bill that's not only going to kill our industry, but increase taxes on rural working Oregonians that are already struggling due to the coronavirus and bad forest management and everything else going on right now.
Absolutely. You've also got a double whammy right now because of the forest burning, but now needing lumber to rebuild these houses and these businesses. Do you think it's occurred to DeFazio that this situation could be a real dilemma here? I mean, what are we supposed to do? Import timber?
Well, actually, we have been importing timber.
Yes.
A lot of the mills in Oregon's 4th Congressional District, even though we're the timber capital of the world, have been importing trees from Canada and Washington just so that the mill doesn't go out of business. And that's heartbreaking to me because, again, that's money that should be going to our economy and county governments and jobs that should be staying here in Oregon's 4th Congressional District instead of going to Canada or the Southeast.
So getting back to some good things here that we've seen during this time of crisis, talk to us a little bit about your own efforts to help people out. What have you been able to do during this time of crisis?
I mean, I've just done whatever I can. We've just, you know, brought water bottles and snacks to fire camps and have helped, you know, feed evacuees from the fires. But I mean, really, it's what blows me away is not really what I've been able to do, but just what the community has done as a whole. I mean, they've literally had to tell people to stop bringing donations to places just because they've had so many. The outreach from our community to all these people that have had to flee these terrible fires has been absolutely amazing. And it makes me incredibly proud to be from Western Oregon when I see things like that.
Absolutely. It really has been pretty wonderful. And, you know, one of the things that really impressed me during all of that, during the heat of the battle there, and people are trying to get, you know, people out of the way and livestock out of the way. I was out there tweeting things, which doesn't seem very much. But what was really cool, though, about that was that I noticed that when I would say, you know, here's some resources here, or if you're, you know, need help, contact these people and those kinds of things. And it was being retweeted by people with whom I would probably disagree about 95% or more on my politics. And yet they were putting all of that aside, where everybody was. We were putting all of that aside to get help to people. I just think that was really pretty cool to see that. I wish we could see more of that.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, when it comes to forestry, I mean, we're going to need to figure out a compromise if anything is ever going to get done on it. I mean, we've tried this hyper partisanship for 30 years and it hasn't gotten us anywhere. And like, again, as a result, the forests are burning at an incredible rate. So we really need to figure out some compromise and actually get something done on the issue, because I hope that this terrible fire season that we're having is really a wake-up call to a lot of people that something needs to be done, and we can't continue just to have a hands-off approach to our federal forest lands.
No, absolutely not. You know, but while Oregonians have come together, there really is something else out there. Some of these wildfires have been because of arson. There are rumors that some of these fires may have been set by Antifa. Regardless of who's doing it, though, there have been arrests for arson. At a time like this, I mean, it is just absolutely reprehensible that somebody would be out there doing this. We're going to talk about this more in more detail with our next guest, Scott McEwen, but I'd like to get your opinion. What should happen to these arsonists, especially if they turn out to be coordinated by groups like Antifa or Black Lives Matter?
I mean, whether they're coordinated or not, they should be punished to the full extent of the law. And even then, regardless of if there are arson or not, I mean, the reason these fires have grown to the size that they've grown is our forest management. So, I mean, absolutely, arson's a terrible thing, and I don't know what these people are thinking when they do it, and they should absolutely be punished. But what really makes it even 10 times worse is really how we're managing our forest. So It's just, I mean, I just don't think that any of us could have foreseen not only how bad the forests would be these days, but also how divided this country is, and that there's people out there that are willing to set forest fires and harm, in some cases, their own state, either for selfish reasons or to prove a political point. To me, it's just insane. And I mean, I hope that whether or not they're affiliated with any political group, one way or another, I mean, they should be punished to the full extent of the law regardless.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go and take a break there. We'll continue with Alex Garlados, a former Oregon National Guardsman and now a candidate for Oregon's CD4. Stay with us. And welcome back. Talking with Alex Garlados, who's a former Oregon National Guardsman and now a candidate for U.S. Congress in Oregon's 4th Congressional District. That's in the southwest corner of the state. And we were talking during the break there that it sounds like you guys are doing pretty well with fundraising. Talk to us a little bit about that, because people wouldn't be donating to you unless they were terribly excited about you.
Oh, no. We have so much momentum on our side. It's crazy. I mean, we've been out fundraising Peter DeFazio since the first of the year. Last quarter alone, we outraised him by $600,000. And I just think that's a great sign when it comes to obviously being able to spend dollar for dollar against a 33-year incumbent, but also just as a sign of the momentum and excitement and how really we're hoping that it's going to be a really good year for not only our campaign, but Republican politics as a whole in Oregon.
I sure hope so. Yeah, I sure hope so. You know, last time we had interviewed you, I had taken a peek at his fundraising numbers, and although he's been low in fundraising, he did have a sizable war chest still socked away in his bank account, something like $2 million, which is a pretty big hurdle to overcome. But we were also talking during the break there about, you know, has he started some attack ads? And I'm just blown away by the fact that he has been accusing you of wanting to fund Planned Parenthood, of all things.
No. He says, I want to defund Planned Parenthood, Social Security, and Medicare. And while I don't think that, you know, religious Christians or any real religious sect should be funding Planned Parenthood with their tax dollars, I don't believe that we should defund Medicare or Social Security. That's just an outright lie. I mean, I don't know where he even got that from, but I mean, that's just politics, I guess. And that's why people don't like politicians.
No, it's amazing how quickly they can just drop these lies. I mean, we have certainly seen that over 4 years of Trump with the Democrats just attacking him. The news media just out there attacking, just dropping absolutely in-your-face, bald-faced kinds of lies. It's not at all shocking that he's accusing you of these things. You know, a lot of people really don't start paying attention to politics until a few weeks before the election. How are you lighting a fire in the bellies of your supporters right now?
We're already on TV, dripping ads and things like that. I think anybody that follows our Facebook or follows our website or anything like that is seeing all the good momentum that we're building up when it comes to our ads that we've been putting out and traction that we've been getting across the district. So we've had so many volunteers, not only from across the state, but even some help from across the country. It's incredible. So many people are excited about this race that it's just truly humbling. And I really hope that this excitement translates into votes in November, and I really think it will.
Oh, I certainly hope so. It's been kind of odd to look through CD4's voting history. There was back in 2000 and 2004, and they went pretty strongly for George W. Bush, but still managed to elect DeFazio. And then again in 2016, one said that Trump won barely, and another one says he lost barely, so I'm not exactly sure which way it went there. But again, it's just real close. And yet DeFazio won again by big numbers. I just hope that when people mark the ballot for Trump, the very next thing they vote for is Alex Garlados.
Well, I mean, yeah, this was the closest congressional district in the country that Donald Trump lost in 2016. So it is very competitive and Republicans can win it. Unfortunately, on the congressional level, there just hasn't been a decent candidate that was able to fundraise and target moderates when running against DeFazio. I mean, he's been there since 1987 and has never had to run a tough election, which is really, I mean, ridiculous. This district should be Republican already.
Oh, absolutely.
And especially the way he's represented it over the last 30 years. And now we're the poorest congressional district in the state after he's had 33 years to change it is reprehensible. And we're hoping to really change that if elected.
So what does he blame that on? I mean, if you got elected in 1972, you've been there roughly 30 years, and your district has gotten more and more poor, I mean, what's his answer to that?
Well, he's been in office since 1987 in Congress anyway, and I don't think anyone's ever really asked him a question, and that's really part of the problem. No one's ever said, you know, hey, Peter, why is your district so poor, and why is homelessness rates so high and child abuse rates so high? He's never had to answer that question, and no one's really held him accountable, at least not in the media. And so we're going to definitely do that and raise those points when running against him. I mean, we're not attacking Peter DeFazio on anything he's done in his personal life or hasn't done. We're simply attacking him on his voting record and what he stands for. I mean, you really should have no excuse after 33 years and a chairman in Congress for not being able to do something for your district. I mean, he has power, he has seniority, and hopefully a lot of friends on the Democratic side of the aisle, and he still can't get anything done for his district, and he's never passed a major piece of legislation.
Yeah, astonishing. And during his time, he had Bill Clinton. They had majorities in the House during the Clinton era and also again in Obama, and yet still can't seem to do anything. You have a terrific ad. It's a little long to play on the radio. It's 3 minutes and change, but we're going to put it up on iSpy Radio on today's show page. You say DeFazio lives on a yacht near Washington, D.C. Is that really true? And how many people in CD4 live on yachts?
I don't know very many. but yes, he lives on a yacht in the D.C. Yacht Club. I'm not sure if he does it. I'm not sure why he does it. But it might be to get out of D.C. taxes, which I know are very high. But regardless, I mean, that's about as out of touch as you can get.
Yes, absolutely. We got about a minute here with you. What help do you need? What besides, you know, the obvious donations, are there things that people can do for you?
Oh, absolutely. We need volunteers to help make phone calls, write postcards, even knock on doors. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of support, but what we really need is people talking about us in the district. So if you'd like to volunteer, you can shoot us an email at alec4oregon. Or, word of mouth, just sharing our stuff on your Facebook or telling your friends and neighbors about us would be great.
And that website, one more time, Alec4, is that the number 4 or just F-O-R?
Spelled out, A-L-E-K-F-O-R, Oregon.com.
Okay, we'll make sure that we link that up too. Alec, this has been great. We are wishing you all the best. I want to have you back one more time but right before the election. But things sound like they're going well. Let's hope that that momentum continues.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, as always.
I'd like to welcome Mel Scott McEwen back to the show. He's the best-selling co-author of the New York Times best-selling American Sniper and author of his own series of books, including Sniper Elite and the Camp Valor series. Scott, it's great to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Mark. I'm glad to be back on.
Absolutely. You know, since you're a former Oregonian and a former lawyer, I'd like to tap into both of those areas of expertise and really talk about the fires here in Oregon. The FBI has been saying, no, Antifa is not setting fires. They actually sent out a tweet about this saying that Antifa was not setting these fires, which is kind of an odd thing to say on the surface of it. How do they know? I mean, that's like saying we have 100% perfect knowledge of every Antifa member in the United States, that they have 100% perfect access to all of their internal communications, even whispered in-person conversations. Why would the FBI issue a blanket statement like that?
You know, I find it very, very troubling, you know, because I don't think that they can factually say that. And then the other thing that really troubles me, Mark, is this. You know, we know that these guys from the Antifa and other groups have been lighting fires creating havoc, looting, rioting in Portland for at least 100 some days. I don't know if there's still that activity still going on, but I suspect it probably is. In any event, we know they've tried to burn down a federal courthouse on multiple occasions. We know they lit fires and tried to burn down the condominium complex where the mayor of Portland actually lives. And yet, you know, we know that they've also done activities in more rural areas beyond the urban areas. And so I question why this group that has such a propensity not only to commit crimes, but to light fires, is immediately exonerated from potential, if you will, irresponsibility. I don't think it's responsible for the FBI to do it. I don't know what the reason is, but, you know, I don't think this is a protected class of criminals. And I certainly don't think that the statements were responsible by the FBI.
No, I certainly don't think so either. There was some tweets actually by the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office as well that showed the burnout shells of some commercial grade fireworks. Well, gee, Antifa just also happened to be using those, and they had found those about 100 yards off of one of the trails there. So I'm sure that's not at all suspicious either. Hazel, who is one of my Twitter followers, did some terrific sleuthing. And she sent me a list of around 90 fires that had happened in Multnomah County, that's the Portland area, within a 24-hour span. So 90 fires. She lives 17 blocks from the heart of the riots and has watched the destruction of Antifa and BLM has done to the city and the county she calls home. So naturally, she's very concerned about all of this. So she and a friend of hers were listening to the fire department scanner and kept track of them. 90 fires in 24 hours seemed rather high to me. So I asked, how does that compare to a normal 24-hour period? And she wrote back and said there are normally about 6 per day. So that's a 15-fold increase. That seems to be pretty clear evidence that this is not simply lightning strikes out there. But it's even more obvious the connection when she says this, quote, P.S., the riots completely stopped when the fires started. So does that prove that Antifa BLM is out there setting fires? No, not necessarily. But you'd think that someone would pay attention to that. Why would they ignore obvious correlations like this and claim it couldn't possibly be Antifa or BLM? I mean, is it possible from a legal standpoint that they could be trying to quietly build a case? Is that why they've been out there saying, no, it's not them?
I think that generally the federal government in that circumstance would make no comments whatsoever. In other words, they wouldn't say yay or nay or anything in between. They would just basically not comment upon it. So, no, I don't think that's what's going on here. I mean, I don't know what the pressure is. I don't know what that local FBI office is. I don't know who runs it, et cetera. But we do know that there are politics within the FBI, unfortunately. And we do know that, for some reason, you know, the powers that be in Oregon want to protect a class of people that have been committing crimes and burning the place down for the last, you know, 3+ months. And it mystifies me why they should either be protected or even thought about in a positive light, because we know what their propensity is.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Daily Caller on Thursday reported that the Department of Justice is considering bringing charges against local Portland officials over allegedly mishandling of riots and demonstrations. They're probing how city officials were handling or not handling the violent unrest. Government officials are notoriously hard to sue, but could charges be brought in this case for inaction?
I think in a circumstance such as what we saw in Seattle, where basically the government let certain sectors of their city be taken over, I think the cases by those business owners in those areas, such as the Chop Zone or whatever it was called, you know, I think they have a very good case. Now, in a more general sense, you know, I guess if I put my lawyer's hat on and looked at this in a situation like, for example, you know, you might have had where you didn't come down as hard as you might have on demonstrations or something of that nature, I think it's a much more difficult case. And I don't think, you know, unless you see clear evidence that the government officials were conspiring with those that were committing the crimes, I just don't see it's an actionable. I don't think it's got much ground to really make anything out of that type of claim.
So in terms of charges, there's some other situations that have been happening. We had a friend of ours. She's a realtor in the Salem area. She was being threatened both on social media. These two women were calling her, threatening her over the phone and threatening her business, saying that she'd never sell another house in the Salem area. A cousin of ours is being threatened with violence in their area. We've got Biden supporters making threats on social media, on the phone calls, as we just said. But we've also seen rioters going into neighborhoods and threatening people in their homes. What can be done about that? I mean, if you're making threats, isn't there some kind of charge that can be leveled?
I think if it is a threat coupled with, if you will, a real ability to act upon the threat. In other words, I think something on the internet is much more difficult to charge upon than, say, for example, Black Lives Matter people trying to knock down your door, or these rioters trying to knock down your door, as we've seen in certain examples in some of these riots. Now, I think the latter is certainly actionable because they're in your property or at your property. They're actively attempting to assault you or whatever else. So I think that can be done. Now, these threats on the internet, which we see more and more in these, you know, we're going to put you out of business or you'll never do business again. Obviously, it has to be a threat that's actionable and that is real in its ability to, I guess, that person to do that crime. Or, number one, it's very difficult to prosecute. Number two, I don't see the government doing anything to even attempt to do it when you're letting people actively run the streets and burn things and, you know, if you will, shoot people with lasers and, you know, things of that nature, you know, and they're not prosecuting those crimes. I don't think the chances of those other, if you will, internet crimes are even remotely, going to be prosecuted.
No, sadly not. All right, let's go and take a break there. All of those riots out there, guess what? They weren't spontaneous. We'll talk about that next with Scott McEwen. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Scott McEwen. He's the best-selling co-author of American Sniper and also a couple of series of his own books, the Sniper Elite series and Camp Valor. We'll have all of those up on iSpyRadio.com if you want take a look at those. Absolutely fantastic books. Really enjoying the Camp Valor series. So, Scott, going on to that last break there, we're talking about people getting threats. I had wanted to ask you, if people do get some pretty serious threats, like especially over the phone calls, that's a step up from saying some nasty, snipey things on social media. What can they do or what should they do?
Well, I think it's always good to inform the police, you know, that you've been threatened. You know, if you know the source of the threat, to give them the idea, and also, you know, to let them know what's going on. You know, I personally am an advocate of the Second Amendment. So,
yes.
You know, ultimately your responsibility to protect yourself, you know, whether you like to think it is or not, is your own. And, and sometimes you must look at how real those threats are and make your own decisions relative to how you're going to protect you and your family. Because, I mean, as we've seen recently, you know, you can't always count on the police showing up because sometimes there's just so much stuff going on. There's just no ability.
So, Scott, we had sent you a great article from The Federalist. It's titled How the 1960s Riots Foreshadowed Today's Communist Weaponization of Black Pain. And it is really fascinating article. We're going to make sure that we have that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And this probably shouldn't surprise anyone. There's a connection there, correlation. Since the founders of BLM proudly said in several interviews that they were in fact trained Marxists, but among the more interesting aspects of that article was this: the riots then and the riots now are not spontaneous. These are actually well planned, well organized, and build on years of undermining the police and years of grievance stoking to make the fires blow up when there's an opportune moment, like what we saw with the George Floyd situation. In that article, they mentioned the Newark riots of 1967, which killed 26 people. But in order to get to that point, it took 3 years of pot stirring in that neighborhood in Newark until things exploded when the time was right. But what was fascinating to me is, as I analyzed that article, what stood out to me was how unappealing socialism and Marxism really is when it gets down to it. Because if an ideology is so appealing to people, why would you need 3 years of behind-the-scenes shadowy planning?
That's a good point. I think what you have to realize, though, with the socialist movements and the Marxist movements that we've seen historically, and, you know, and I agree with that correlation with the riots, you know, that they used to do, is that the organizers must create turmoil, and they must create either race turmoil or social equality turmoil, or preferably for them, both. And so you really have to have a situation where the race kind of thing kind of baits it, and they race bait these things to start. And then this whole social equality, reparations, it's okay to steal things as long as, because they are reparations, which is another thing the Black Lives Matter movement is saying now, is you can break into people's homes and businesses and steal things because those are just reparations for past crimes. So you kind of tie in that whole, if you will, underclass mentality with, you know, with the racist stuff, and the two together cause this incendiary, if you will, devices that we see now, and they certainly are planned. And you know what's really amazing, Mark, is you can probably take the group that's actually planning it and get it down to probably less than 100 individuals total in the United States.
Yes.
And that's what I think the federal government should be focusing on.
Yes, and I think that's very true. In fact, that's right where I was going, is that these rioters are very well funded, and in order to give the appearance of widespread grievance and larger numbers than they actually are, they will travel from city to city to stoke this fire and then that fire. How is that not a federal crime if they're being funded and then moving across these state lines to keep stoking hate and division?
I think it is a federal crime, and I think it's a federal crime under many statutes, you know, insurrection, et cetera, as well as RICO, as well as, you know, the fact that these groups are being funded and, you know, and are highly funded. And, you know, and I think that the federal government really should do a better job of looking into this. I really believe that if Trump is reelected, we are going to see a crackdown on this,
yes,
the likes of which a lot of people don't realize. I think that they've had enough, and I think that they have the wherewithal. They're just kind of keeping the gloves on during this election, if you will, stage. But once he, hopefully he gets back in, they're going to clean this stuff up, I really believe, Mark.
Yes. Oh, well, I absolutely think so, too. I think they're just salivating, waiting for that chance to be able to go in there and start busting this apart and really start exposing things. But one thing that is a little bit, I guess, disturbing is when they keep coming across these rioters, why are they not immediately transferred from, especially if they can prove that they, and apparently there is video evidence, if they can prove that they have moved from one city to the next, why are they not immediately transferred from local or state control to federal control, where they can then be held without bail or some other federal charges? I mean, wouldn't that put a stop to the spread of all of this?
It seems to me that that's the tactics that are being used now in Portland. I mean, I think that when the Portland State Patrol basically told the governor of Oregon, we're not going to go do your bidding. You know, if you're not going to prosecute these people because your local DA, many might argue, was funded by Soros, that he won't prosecute these crimes that we're arresting people for, so therefore we're not going to do it anymore. And then, as you saw, those Oregon State Patrol were deputized by the federal government, and a lot of these charges were brought under federal crimes. Now, I don't know if it's having an effect yet or not, but I do know that they are making an effort to bring these crimes in federal court, and I think it will ultimately have an effect on these things, and I do believe they will be more successful in their prosecution.
Well, I certainly hope so. It's interesting that you brought up Soros, because he was trending on Twitter late Wednesday night. Because did you see that really weird interview where Newt Gingrich was being interviewed on Fox News, and he brought up the fact that Soros had funded a lot of these DAs? Didn't mention the Secretary of State, but he was mentioning, especially on these DA races, where these are the ones that got elected by Soros's money, and they're the ones not putting any of these charges, in fact, dropping charges, which I think is absolutely reprehensible. And then the Fox News people basically hung up on him. Did you happen to see that exchange?
You know, I did. And I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of arguments out there that Fox is becoming much more left wing because of the, you know, Murdoch's kids have taken more control of the network. But that being said, I heard that whole thing. I don't know what the whole spin out was yet, but I heard that Gingrich was actually, you know, somehow banned from being on it again. You know, like they've got some kind of a effective ban going on, which would be really outrageous. But that being said, he's right. I don't care what anybody says. It happened. It's been happening all over the United States. It happened with the prosecutor in Illinois that dropped the Juicy Smollett case. It's happening with a lot of these prosecutors that refuse to prosecute these quote protesters that are looting and burning these cities. And I'm telling you right now, they were funded by Soros. And I think that guy is another one that should be investigated by the federal government, because I truly believe that he is a criminal as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you've also got this situation in Missouri where the DA there launched a FBI, James Comey-style fake investigation, leveled all of these charges that they had invented and brought down the governor there. And not to mention here in Oregon, our own Secretary of State was a George Soros appointee. And she managed to get herself moved up to governor when Kitzhaber was forced to step down after that scandal. So he's got his fingers in a lot of pies for sure. All right, let's take a break here. Come back. We'll talk about sedition. Why is that no longer a thing? And welcome back into our final segment now here with author Scott McEwen. He is the best-selling author, co-author of American Sniper, and also the film of that same name. And Scott, I went out of that break saying, why is sedition no longer a crime? This is something that I've been looking at what's going on in Portland after 100 days of this. They are out there saying that they want to destroy America. They're out there saying they want to burn down the system. News finally broke late Wednesday that Barr had urged federal prosecutors last week to charge violent demonstrators with a range of offenses, including sedition, a charge usually reserved for someone plotting to overthrow the government. I mean, again, they have said they want to overthrow the government. Why is it that sedition is so rarely used?
I just think it became a crime that there were so many other crimes that would subsume, if you will, and be much easier to prosecute than sedition. In other words, if you were committing terrorist acts, which would probably be seditious acts, it would be easier to charge you under terrorism statutes and things of that nature. I don't know why. You know, I was never a prosecutor in my practice, Mark, so I can't say that I'm an expert on the prosecution of sedition per se. But I just think it became such a general crime in the past, and there's so many more specific crimes that I just expect that prosecutors did not hold it in favor, and it was more difficult to if you would, gain a conviction.
Well, getting back to those 1967 riots that we talked about in that last segment, Hayden, I forget his last name, he was an organizer with the Students for Democratic Society who helped plan those 1967 Newark riots, said this in a New York Times Review of Books op-ed, quote, "The role of organized violence is now being carefully considered. During a riot, for instance, a conscious guerrilla can participate in pulling police away from the path of people engaged in attacking stores. He can create disorder in new areas the police think are secure. He can carry the torch, if not all the people, to white neighborhoods and downtown business districts. If necessary, he can successively shoot to kill." That was 1967. I mean, it seems odd that we've had all of these years since, five decades and change, how is it that we've allowed those kinds of people to exist in the society that are clearly trying to destroy the system? I mean, you don't just let a cancer sit there. They're actively planning the overthrow of our government. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it should be allowed.
Well, it shouldn't be allowed. And I think that the people that really want to live in a peaceful world and one that has law and order, and whatever part of society or neighborhood they live in, be that, you know, more Hispanic, black, white, or whatever, all want the same thing. I mean, when you look at these folks, you know, in these more, if you will, these more economically challenged black communities, when they ask them, do you want to get rid of the police? They overwhelmingly say, no, we do not, because they know what that means for them, and they know how little protection they will have if the police are not there. And I think that that's a very telling statistic. What has happened here is that the storm that has come upon us, in my estimation, took place in an election time under the aegis of, quote, black lives being, quote, threatened by the police. And I think that perfect storm that was developed as a result of that and the riots, et cetera, that it kind of overwhelmed people, and that the federal powers that be at the time were very hesitant to come down on it. In addition to that, we have a local governments that are supposed to be in charge of that policing, almost all controlled by Democratic, sometimes extremely left-wing socialist Democratic mayors and governors, in the case of Portland and Oregon. And so those people have no interest in actually taking care of it, Seattle, places like that, because they like to see the mayhem and they believe that it helps their political ends. So I think we have a very bad, if you will, storm that all took place at once during a very, very, if you will, contentious election year. And so people are not ready to take the gloves off. I'm hopeful that very soon people are going to see these groups for what they are. And I believe the American people are going to are going to demand that this violence and that this looting and that this burning stop. And I don't care what you're trying to protest. It does not matter. That doesn't give you a license to commit crimes and to burn people's houses down, period, end of story.
No, absolutely not. I think for sure that this is starting to turn against them. I think if they had limited it to a couple of weeks, you know, about the George Floyd thing, you know, I can understand the upset about that. But to continue it and to then use that as the excuse to burn down businesses and people's homes and threaten them and everything else, I think at this point people are just beginning to be done with them. We only got a couple minutes here with you. In the law, isn't there something about even if you don't commit a crime, the planning of it, say like a murder, that can get you into jail? I mean, it can't. They obviously can't send you to jail for thinking about committing a crime, but if you make threats and start assembling weapons and other plans, can't that get you into jail? And if so, then why do we allow these Marxists to plan, assemble weapons and cash to commit the murder of America?
I totally agree, and it is a crime. And I just think that they need to start prosecuting these under anti-terrorism statutes. We know that if terrorists have plots to blow things up, to do things, whatever, and start assembling weapons in furtherance of that plot, they can be convicted of that crime. So I really believe that the shift needs to be to the point where they need to start treating these groups as what they are, and they really are domestic terrorist organizations. They're planning things out. They're financing things. They're doing the stuff we see in Middle Eastern countries. We're doing the stuff that we saw Al-Qaeda do prior to 9/11. I mean, I think it is that serious, and I think it is that devastating.
Yes.
And when they start focusing, the federal government should look at these under the terrorism statutes, because that's exactly what we have going on.
And you are absolutely right. Scott, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I absolutely agree with you there. We will definitely have you back on as soon as we can. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Now that is the kind of fire we need. Did you see where now Nancy Pelosi is saying that these rioters need to be held accountable? Some internal poll must have come along that said $2 billion in damages, violence, killing cops, looting, and all of that destruction just doesn't make us look very good. What gets me is they thought people actually wanted that. Sorry, Democrats, you are done. You don't protect people, you don't protect businesses, and you certainly don't protect our forests, and none of us need a poll to tell us how to think on those. A reminder, if you live in a Republican-safe district or an all-hope-is-lost district, put your efforts into supporting a Republican in a close district like our guest Alex Carlatos. You don't even need to be in his district to volunteer. In the heart of a Democrat-destroyed district, you can help get a Republican elected. Think of it as a little payback for all that Democrat destruction. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.